The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, technology everywhere. So, this morning, what I'd like to do is to hear from you a little bit what kind of questions you might have about practice, and maybe perhaps have some discussion around things. So it might take a few minutes for you to change your focus from sitting there expecting a Dharma talk to getting, you know, to ask your questions. But a good Dharma student should always have a question. I think half of Dharma practice is having questions. You know, what's going on here? What's going on here with my life? What's happening here? What's this about? So, my question for you is, what's going on for you? I'd like to know.
You've mentioned that one of the subtle things that we can cling to in deep meditation are mind states.
Sure.
Of various sorts. Could you talk about that a little bit? What those are, what they seem like?
People can cling to mind states in any state, not just deep meditation. So mind states are, you know, the variety of things, but the generalized mood or overall state that our inner life has at any given time. So a person might have a happy thought, there might be so much happiness that it kind of colors their whole state, their whole mood, their whole way of being. So you see someone walking down the street and just obvious they're happy because there's a state there. Or if they're walking down the street grumpy, it's obvious. You know, you can have a grumpy thought, but if you're kind of consumed by the grumpiness, then your overall state is colored by that, is shaped by that. So the state of the mind is your overall state, shape, mood, coloring of the mind, and there's a whole series of them. So there's, you know, happiness, sadness, anger, generosity, love, compassion. There can be states of mind which are very peaceful, a lot of equanimity and tranquility. So you ask about deep states of meditation. So in deep states of meditation, the state of the mind is no longer shaped by the afflictive emotions, by the emotions that cause afflictive pain and trouble, the reactive emotions. There are emotions which are that occur in reaction to something happening in the world, no longer happen in deep meditation, or happen very little. So, for example, if I win the California lottery, perhaps I would be depressed. But someone else might be happy, and that, you know, that both the happiness and the depression is a reaction to winning it, and so it's a reactive emotion. In deep meditation, there's not a tendency to react that kind of way to experience. So that kind of reactive happiness wouldn't happen, and that kind of reactive sadness wouldn't happen. The emotional states, or the interstimental states that predominate in deep states of meditation are deeply satisfying ones. Some people would say beautiful ones. And so there are things like peace and tranquility, joy, happiness, equanimity. Because they're so satisfying, they can feel not only satisfying, very meaningful, very enjoyable. It's very easy to get attached to them, get attached to the pleasure of them, but also attached to the meaning of them. Wow, look at this. This means I'm a good meditator. This means that I've really gotten far on my path, and it's really important to get somewhere in this path. So finally, I've arrived somewhere. I'm not sure where, but... Or, you know, there's a whole series of reasons why a person might get attached to those experiences. Occasionally, the attachment takes the form of a resistance to them. They can be so different from ordinary kinds of ways of experiencing oneself that people resist them, or frightened of them even. Often, our sense of self is closely tied to the reactive emotions, reactive mind states. And the sense of self often is the very mechanism by which or through which we react to things. So when the reactive mind is no longer going on, the usual sense of self quiets down quite a bit. And that can feel very frightening to some people. And so the attachment has a negative attachment. You know, oh no, I'm not going to go there, even though it's so wonderful. Does that address your concern, or do you want to ask some more?
Oh, that's fine. Thank you, Gil.
As I practice, you know, over the years, it seems like about once a year I just get stuck on something. And now I'm stuck on my mind is stuck on fixing other things, fixing other people. I'm embarrassed to admit. Can you give me any insights on this? You might not want me to.
You just chose the wrong people to fix.
Help. That's all I can say. Yeah. No, things don't interest me as much.
Sorry?
Fixing things don't interest me as much as people. Help. My mind is going there like all the time, every time I stop and watch it.
So you prefaced your comments by saying that every year you seem to get stuck on some particular thing, and this year it's people, fixing people. And what has helped you in the past when you're stuck?
In the past, like when I was in the first year or so of meditating and I stopped to really look at my thoughts, I spent a whole weekend just looking at my thoughts, I discovered I was spending an enormous amount of time having arguments in my head that never occurred and feeling all the emotions. And when I saw that, it seemed to melt away. I mean, once I got the awareness, this one, I've been seeing it and trying the same technique, and it's not melting away. It's just running. The program's still running.
So I wonder if you've gotten deep enough. Maybe you haven't sat still enough with it to really kind of get to the source of what's driving that desire.
Do you mean the desire to hold on to the rumination or the desire to fix?
Well, in this case, probably the desire to fix. What's the source of that in her? What's motivating, what's prompting that is some concern, something that's very important for you. And so what is it that's at the heart of it? What's really important for you? And so chances are you're clinging to something, you're holding on to something, but something that's probably important. It could be dysfunctionally important, but that doesn't matter. It's still important and should be respected. And so, can you sit still enough or investigate enough to really get down to the heart of it? And sometimes that process can happen through strong sitting, where you really sit with those experiences. Like try to find some situation. Find yourself in some situation where the fix-it mind is really powerful. And at that time, excuse yourself and go meditate and just sit with those feelings and the thoughts and really try to be still and kind of watch in the way that you know how and see what gets unpacked and what gets revealed as you do that. If that doesn't seem to help at some point, then you might want to try other approaches. Some people find really helpful to journal, so they can kind of, somehow the process of free associated writing can sometimes release kind of subconscious thoughts, ideas, associations, feelings in a way that maybe can't be released in meditation. The other thing that can happen is that, so talking with a friend, you know, or a therapist, you know, can be very helpful to kind of unpack or loosen up some of the places where it's really dense. We can't see it because of the density of what's happening. And another approach, which can be very effective, is to two things, or two ways of ignoring it. One is just to ignore it entirely. And just whenever it's there, just kind of like brush it aside. Be very diligent to brush it aside like you would a pesky fly. And it might be that it just atrophies by itself. You don't give it any attention. And sometimes giving it attention, oh, this is really important, I'm not supposed to be fixing it kind of person, I've got to deal with it. It's the very thing that kind of keeps it going. You've probably seen that with kids, you know. Sometimes you're better off, my kid, you know. You know, well, you know, he wants something really, but desperately, and no, you can't have that. But I want that. And as long as you engage him in the process, it's hopeless. I'll never win. So at some point, you just have to ignore it. You know, and then if he doesn't get any attention, then, you know, he goes off and finds something else to do. So the ignoring it sometimes works. But there's another approach to ignoring, which is ignore it as a strategy, and instead cultivate the best you can really deep states of meditative well-being. Try to get yourself really concentrated and still. And then from that deep concentration and stillness, from that vantage point, turn around and look at the fix-it. Try to see what's going on. And it's a very different vantage point. It's kind of like maybe an image would be that, say that we have a layer, if you use this image, layer of attachment in us. And that attachment generates a lot of our thoughts and concerns and all that. So those thoughts and concerns happen above the attachments. So from the place of our concerns and preoccupations and thoughts, we're trying to look down at the place of attachment. That's one approach. The other approach is to bypass the attachment and get to a deeper state of peace, and then from there, look up at it. And then it can be a very different relationship to it, and very different understanding of what has to happen, and very different approach to our relationship to it as well. Because sometimes it's not the problem we've identified is maybe not really the real problem. The problem is the way we relate to the problem. And so so I'm not saying this is your situation, but someone can see that they're stuck in some way, and they think, well, I'm doing this Buddhist practice, and Buddhists are not supposed to be stuck, and here I'm a bad person, I have to fix this, and this is terrible for me. And so it's all this added complications that actually makes it a much bigger monster than it really is. Once we kind of take away being a good Buddhist and all that, it's just a little bit of stuckness. And it happens all the time. And then maybe it kind of could dissolve more easily. But I think it's important to be very respectful of how strong some of the attachments we have. Some things are not easy to dissolve or to let go of very easily. Some things can take years. And to be involved in a process that slowly begins to wear them out or thin them out or soften them, weaken them, is a very mature way of practicing. To expect that you're going to find the magic key that, boom, you know, I know I have a problem there and I just got to find the button to push and then I'll be happier ever after, is not so realistic. So something just take their time. And so in terms of your fix-it things, it might be that you have to see it again and again and again. And the main thing you need to do is to train yourself not to give into it. And if you train yourself not to give into it, then it doesn't cause any problems in your life, but you haven't necessarily fixed your fix-it problem. So is that address it well enough?
That's very helpful. That gives me a lot of different approaches to try to fix it.
Thank you. Up here in the front.
I wanted to ask, I guess, in a way you maybe answer this question, I mean, with your prior answer, but it's a little bit a different spin because I kind of have, I always like have this subtle way of wanting to have power over people and not like, you know, I don't want their car keys and their PIN number and stuff like that. But, you know, but like I find that there are little ways and then when I was walking the other day, I looked at this house that's on sale in my neighborhood and they're staging it and they put like a new classic car, just like all the cars over at Redwood High School. They put like a classic car in there and they fix up the garden and everything. And I kind of realized like we're constantly getting a message, like we're having to stage ourselves or, you know, always, it's kind of like we're always playing these tricks on each other and like you can either play the tricks or you can see the tricks and just be disgusted, and everywhere you turn you're kind of disgusted. So I guess my question is that even when you talk about all these the process being engaged, even the process can be turned into a way of wanting of having power over people and stuff. And so I don't know if you have any. It seems like power can be it's like you can turn anything into a power hierarchy or whatever, a power system.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And how do you, I don't know, do you have that? Have you ever dealt with that in your practice, or do you have any response?
Victor, I think he's pointing at my podium. My I tried to avoid sitting up here, but all of you insisted I had to sit on this thing.
You lost that power.
I lost that power. I'm not sure where to jump in on you. You said so much. One thing is that I hope there's other alternatives besides being disgusted in seeing how people are trying to manipulate or trick each other or advertise for different things, you know, kind of ways. I mean, I think it's very wise to see, oh, look at that. They put a classic car there to try to create a nice image so someone's tricked and thinking that they can live the American dream if they buy this house. And so, oh, look at that. You know, it's kind of unfortunate that people have to operate that way, but it just, you know, it's kind of human nature well enough, and I'm glad I have a practice that helps me to free myself of this, and I hope that they'll find a practice that, you know, the wisdom to see through these kinds of tricks. I don't think it's necessary to be disgusted. But I think it's helpful to be wise and to see it clearly for what it is. Now, in terms of power, there's different kinds of power, but power over someone else, where you get someone to do something that you want them to do against their will, or without them knowing that you're actually kind of fixing them or manipulating them. That's something we want to do. That's something you want to be very careful with, and because it's kind of like stealing. It's like taking something which is not given, and so that's one of the precepts. We don't want to take something that's not given. So it's best to it speaks well for you that you see it in yourself. There's a lot of people who do this one way or the other, without knowing it, kind of almost unconsciously, and it takes all kinds of forms. There are overt ways we see, oh, that person's doing a power play over someone else, because they're really strong and domineering or something. But there's some people who are very brilliant and taking control and having power over others by being very shy and victim and, poor me. And so then everyone kind of gathers around that person, and they successfully kind of, gathered everyone around them, take care of them. And that's a use of power too. So I think that seeing it as taking what's not given, and I think is maybe helpful, and then to ask permission, or say, be overt, say what you're doing. This is what I'm doing. I would like to sell this house, and I'd like people to think that it's the American dream. So I've made it look like the American dream with a station wagon and a dog and two kids. So I don't know if that was a good example, but the idea being that I think we can ask or explain what we're doing and be honest with what we're doing, then it can be safe. The more we can be honest with what we're doing and talk about it, I think the safer it is for everyone. So there's power over someone. But there's also a different kind of power, strength, of leadership, kind of personal power, personal strength, personal forcefulness, that sometimes people are shy to use, because sometimes it frightens some other people, or they're afraid to frighten other people. But there's ways of being being forceful that is appropriate, that's not necessarily wrong or bad. And sometimes it's really great to meet people like that, because you're challenged to try to find yourself, how to hold your own ground with that person. how not to be pushed around, or how not to give in to that person, or how not to run away from that person, but to kind of evoke the same level of inner stability or strength, kind of meet that person as well. So, you know, a forceful personality or a forceful sense of purpose doesn't necessitate power over someone. And so there's differentiation. I think it's been useful for me to see in my life. So I don't know. What do you think? Did that address your concern, or you want to ask further?
No, I guess I'll think about it. I'll reflect.
Great, thank you. So all the way in the back there, someone's asking in the back hall.
I've been coming for a couple of months, so I'm relatively new, both to meditation and to this particular center. I find myself getting very distracted in the process of trying to meditate, and when people come in a little bit later, I hear the doors opening, and some people take their shoes off, and others don't, and I find myself getting kind of aggravated, and then saying, "Why am I getting aggravated?" And I'm thinking, well, they're not being very mindful. And I know it's something, it's up to me. But it might be along the line of the fix-it type of thing. Well, if I could just maybe give them a dirty look or something. So this is my struggle. And then today I focused on the three or four people that came in and were so quiet. And I'm thinking, you're really obsessing about this.
They can't win, can they?
I was looking at the positive. I just wanted to say, oh, thank you for being so considerate. And then again, on the other side, it may be an awareness thing. They're not aware that people are coming in. And I'm thinking, okay, let's just forget this entirely. But anyway, your thoughts are appreciated.
My thoughts.
On this.
I think it's good to have try to have a quiet here when we meditate at 9:25. And certainly, in some ways, I appreciate you bring it up so we can, our whole community can be a little more conscious of this issue. And we've tried over the last months or year or something to try to do a variety of things to make it a little bit more quieter. So we ask people to come in after 9:25 through the back door to make it a little bit quieter. We have, you don't know this, but we've actually moved the front door. It used to be the front door was right where the corner of the shoe rack there, right. So it was so close to the meditation hall, so that so we moved it further back. So things have improved. We used to have a squeaky floor, and so not only it was very clear. It's people came in late, and so things have. We've actually focused on trying to improve it to some degree. There's a limit to how much we can do given the layout of this building here. And also limit to how much I want to do. People coming from a Zen center sometimes say, "Gil, we have to have it lock the door, you know, and people aren't here on time, you know, that's it, you know, they come back next week." And part of our value here is that our understanding is that we're a community meditation center in an urban environment where it's quite difficult for in this kind of environment people to be able to come here, they have work, they have family, they have other obligations. And I'd rather care and make this place a welcoming place for everyone, and so people can come when they can come, rather than saying it has to be a particular way. So between our the kind of layout we are, the kind of community place we are, there's going to be noises like that happen. So we've done a little bit we can to try to minimize it, and bringing it up now, I bet next week it's going to be better. But so that's good. But I don't want people to feel bad about coming late either. And then what you implied as well is that then it becomes your own practice. And we try to do the basic stuff to try with the situation we have to make it work best. But nothing ever works perfect. And so then we have to, it's your practice to work with it. And I think it can be very rich to work with that. So for you, the next few months, you might want to actually always choose the seat that's closest to the door and make that your, like, spot. And then and watch your reactions, your responses, and see all that goes on that inside of you that takes away your peace and ease. And it might be very, very interesting because it's sometimes things like this are microcosms or representative of similar issues in other places in life. And so by learning, using this as a laboratory to understand the reactions, the beliefs, the feelings, the sense of self, the attitude towards others that exists in a situation like that, it's translatable to other situations in life and can be very, very helpful. And then you said you've been coming for a few months, so it's reasonable. One of our concerns about all the sounds has been for people who are new, because it's harder for people who are new to kind of feel safe or feel safe closing their eyes and kind of be here. And so we tried to some degree to do something about it. But those people who are coming for a long time, their attitude generally, not always, generally tends to be that it just becomes part of the background kind of sound. It's just not a problem anymore, just there, and they hardly notice anymore. Or they quite willing, enthusiastically take it on as their practice. Okay, I work with this. Or not so enthusiastically. So that's my thoughts. You asked my thoughts. Is that, you have more to say?
That's wonderful. At one point I even thought that they were plants to challenge me.
Good.
I thought that was too sinister though.
And the one other reflection you might do, you mentioned a variety of reflections that you had used, you know, dealing with it. Another reflection is compassion. We don't know why they're late and what's going on, but there's also an attitude of goodwill, of kindness, of generosity, of friendliness that can be developed as well. I'm so glad you came. I'm so glad you came. I knew it was probably hard to get here, but welcome.
Actually, it wasn't the lateness so much because I'm often late myself. But it's just kind of how one makes one's entrance.
Yes.
And again, that's an individual thing. Mm-hmm. I pride myself on tiptoeing in as if nothing, not to be noticed. But again, that's a very individual thing.
Yeah, great. You know, what's very interesting, the compartmentalization that some people have in their lives. And you see it on retreats as well. It's kind of a natural thing to do. So like on retreats, you have people who are maybe very diligently, slowly during their walking meditation, very diligently sitting there, being very still and mindful. And then the bell ends the walking period, the sitting period, and then they race off to the bathroom, they get a cup of tea, and they're looking at the sky, and they're checking their text messaging, you know, it compartmentalizes a place where you focus on your practice, and then there's the rest of your life where you can just ignore that. And I saw somewhere recently, I think it wasn't a maybe the, I don't know. I saw somewhere recently, someone's commenting. I don't know if it's true at all, but commenting that there are some people who come here and practice here very diligently at IMC, and as soon as they're up on the sidewalk, it's as if they're that's long gone, their mindfulness, their care, and their practice, and they're kind of like, you know, living a whole different life. So, you know, when does our practice start and when does it end? Does it start when we open the door? Does it start when we sit down? Does it start when we leave our home to come here? Or does it never start because it's never stopped? And that's what we're hoping for, is it actually, you have some sense that it never actually stops. You carry your practice with you everywhere. And it's not a compartmentalized world. Because a compartmentalized practice, I don't think you're going to get the full benefits of this practice if you feel like it's only something you do at a particular time and place.
So, can you hear me? Yeah. Just so you know, I recognize I asked you this same question a week ago, but I have to ask you again. You said that one of the reasons people have difficulty staying on the breath is that, here's my interpretation, that you almost invite in the past when you come completely to the present. I'm really having trouble with that concept because
the thing that seems to be keeping me out of the present are thoughts of the past. So are you saying that those thoughts of the past are a shield against the real past?
Great. I thought last week you asked the question, why is it so hard to be in the present, not why it's so hard to be with the breath?
Well, that's sort of the same thing, if you're using the breath to stay in the present, right?
Okay. I don't think it's as complicated as you're making it. So, I'm not sure what to say in reply. So I start with that. So whatever I say, take lightly. There can be a lot of strong, a lot of unresolved issues and feelings from one's past. And there can be a lot of strong emotional attachments to issues and concerns tied to the past. And there can be a lot of focus on thinking about the past can be a lot of motivations for why to think about the past. And people can obsess about the past because of all these things. And generally it's to one's detriment to do this in an obsessive way. And so if a person's really obsessing about the past, then there's two ways of being in the present moment. One way is to choose something like the breath, the breathing, which is always happening in the present, and then train oneself to have the concentration and mindfulness to really stay with the breath, kind of like the breath is the anchor to the present moment. And using that anchor, and coming back and coming back and coming back, slowly weakening the forces of preoccupation, and they kind of atrophy at some point, and the anchor becomes stronger and stronger until you no longer need it, and then you're immediately here. Another approach is to really start understanding what are the forces that are keeping you in the past. Thinking about the past occurs in the present. So there's an art, and it's a difficult art to discover, an art of turning the attention to the phenomena of thinking about the past without necessarily thinking about the past, getting caught in the content, but to really kind of explore and feel what's actually happening here. So we focus on the emotional ground for that kind of thinking. Often there's a strong emotion or variety of emotions that might be there. There might be useful to do some cognitive studies where you really look and see what are the beliefs connected to that past. Do I really think I'm going to have a better past by thinking about it? Am I really going to justify myself by reviewing it over and over again? You know, what are the beliefs connected to it? And then question those beliefs and see if they're really valid. Sometimes issues in the past are things that need to be resolved. Actually, something needs to happen. And if there's a lot of constant obsession about something, then you need to consider whether actually some real thing needs to happen besides just meditating. So, for example, if someone has hurt someone really badly, perhaps you need to go and make amends for that. You've robbed the bank, and you find you can't, just thinking about it over and over and over again, so maybe you have to go back and return the money or something, or turn yourself in. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you, but if it's not possible?
If it's not possible to make amends? If it's not possible to make amends with the person directly, sometimes it's appropriate to do it in other ways. So, maybe that bank's gone out of business and you can't find the creditors or anybody. But maybe then you go and volunteer at Bank Robbers Anonymous just to help support other people, other people so that, they don't do it. So you find other ways, indirect ways. Sometimes you can't make amends directly to the person, people involved. But your heart needs to do something. Your inner heart needs to do some kind of change or switch or something. So something other is helpful. So then to turn and look at that, the whole process of what's going on there, and um, And then when you start getting a little bit of sense of the territory, what's happening there, then trying to understand what's the best approach to dealing with it. Is it really through more meditation? Is that really going to be helpful process? Is it through therapy? Is it through by finding someone you talk to and work things out? Is it through some other kind of process that that you need to have done? So if it's, you know, this constant kind of obsession about the past, it really comes and washes over us in a difficult way. You really need to take it seriously and address it in some way like that. Once that has settled down, and you're able to stay much more in the present moment, and you have some sense of being more kind of stabilized in the present moment somewhat, then you might find that in that stillness or in that silence, there might bubble up memories of the past. And there might be memories that surprise you, you know, because, so if a person's memories are a lot, you know, if a person's obsessions about the past are mostly kind of dark, difficult things, and that finally gets settled and down enough the person can stay in the present moment, and then they stay in the present moment, but they're relaxed and settled, and then up bubbles up this beautiful memory from childhood. Wow, you know, I used to play in my backyard on the swing, and it felt so nice looking at the sky, and I felt so safe and content. It was so wonderful. I forgot about that feeling. Isn't that great? And that memory sometimes is a kind of reincorporation or reintegration of a sense of wholeness or wellness that a person might have had or had a capacity for feeling. On the other hand, it might be some deep, dark demon that's been lurking. And you know, once you settled all those kind of obsessing about the past kind of things that you knew about, you know, and you lo and behold, you had no idea there was this, you know, this great big fierce demon lurking there in the shadows, and it pops up. And so when it bubbles up out of the present, you know, you're really stabilized, calm, settled to some degree, and then something just kind of arises. That's what I was referring to last week. Where it kind of, then I like to think of it, it needs to arise. But once it's arisen, that's all that needs to happen. Then you can let go of it and let the next moment arise and be as it is. Is that helpful?
Yes.
Next week we'll continue. Thank you.
I have a question. It's not working. Hello? I have a question.
This will have to be the last one because we're running late.
Okay, then I'm lucky. So the question is about uncertainty.
About what?
Uncertainty. So, yeah, for example, you are waiting for something, an outcome, but you are not sure what is going to happen, if it's going to one direction or another. So you are have no idea, no mathematics on that. So, but seems some people like me, as a scientific background, engineering, you like to control things. And most of the people don't like that when they don't know what is the outcome. What is your opinion on that?
Sometimes uncertainty is, well, you know, there's what to say about uncertainty. Certainly, if we want to predict the future, the one thing that you can predict with certainty is that it's uncertain. So there's uncertainty is kind of built into the, you know, the whole phenomena of the future occurring. However, as a scientist, the idea of predicting the future is a big part of what science is about, being able to predict likely outcomes of what might happen. So in some situations, it's useful to predict, to analyze, to figure out what might happen. In other situations, predicting and analyzing actually not only is not useful, but actually interferes with some more important process happening. So, for example, if you're a teenager and you're on your first date and you start kind of predicting, you know, when the first kiss should be, and you bring out your piece of paper and start analyzing all the different factors, and there must be 32 different factors you need to kind of consider when the first kiss should be, and you know, and you're supposed to add them up together and multiply, divide by pi, and then kind of figure, you know, she or he is going to be gone before. So, you know, you don't, certain things you don't want to predict that kind of way. You want to engineer, you just kind of like want to just kind of, you know, let something happen. So the inner life, the spiritual life, often has that approach. So you have to have some wisdom about when to step back and let things unfold on their own, because it's actually wiser and richer that way, greater possibilities. And when you need to actually give it serious thought and consideration and try to put all the different elements together carefully. So I don't know, you know, different situations require different approaches. I think what hopefully what the practice can do, mindfulness practice can do, is to do two things. It can help you be more discerning, wiser, about what approach is needed in any given situation. And hopefully it can make you quite flexible and fluid, so it's easy for you to flow back and forth as is appropriate. So you're not stuck on being the engineer all the time. And sometimes you can just drop the engineering approach and you know, and take a whole different... very relaxed, open approach where not knowing, you're quite comfortable not knowing and letting, in the not knowing of the situation, let the situation inform you and teach you. Good luck. So thank you all very much. I appreciated that chance.